global reaction to last night's debate. In Brazil, they're well aware of combative politics.
Politics today is about provocation, to provoke angry reactions from your opponents and to mobilize your political base.
Also last night, talk about a free and fair election in November. The U.S. has long pushed to have election monitors secure other countries' votes.
And it is rather inconceivable that we're finding ourselves in a situation now where we legitimately appear to be having a need for them ourselves.
And a clandestine trip in Iraq, smuggling artifacts to safety.
This collection is very important for all humanity. They're talking about human history.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. A lot of people on Twitter last night wondering how the rest of the globe took in the presidential debate. Well, here's what some of the world heard. If you thought the debate was hard to follow in English, imagine listening to it through interpreters. Two Japanese interpreters struggling to keep up there with all the crosstalk and interruptions. Around the world, media outlets had something of a unanimous verdict. Chaotic, the most ugly debate in American history, was one. A Chinese reporter noted that the candidates had to be chastised by moderator Chris Wallace. Here in the U.S., there's concern over President Trump's refusal to denounce white supremacists and doubling down, telling a hate group to stand by. On China's Weibo platform, the hottest result for the search U.S. election is a video showing the most awkward moments of the debate. In Geneva, Switzerland, Yussi Hanimaki, a professor of international history at the Graduate Institute there, also tuned in.
One of the comments that I've seen is, thank God there's only 5 more weeks of this.
A common reaction. Hanimaki says the debate raised more questions for him than it answered about the state of American democracy.
It's disheartening. I don't know what the right word is, but it's not confidence building for those witnessing this, the show, so to speak, the biggest political show on earth. Witnessing that from the outside, it's concerning.
Arabic-speaking viewers noticed Joe Biden's use of the word inshallah in reference to President Trump ever releasing his tax returns. It means God willing in Arabic and can also be used to imply both doubt and hope that something will ever happen. Arab social media were quick to react, with some calling it a historic moment in America. Our neighbors to the north also tuned in. Mike Bradley is the mayor of Sarnia, Ontario.
To see the type of debate, the level of debate that was so diminished about the future of a country, which had some very serious issues, like all countries do. But when you look at what's going on with civil rights, you look what's going on with COVID, and you're thinking, where is the meat in the direction on moving America forward?
Sarnia is about 65 miles across the Canadian border from Detroit, Michigan. Bradley says that watching from a border city into the U.S., it's like witnessing the decline of the Roman Empire.
In Canada, we are watching very closely what's going to happen on November the 3rd, and perhaps, unfortunately, the days after, as they try to determine the vote. But the reality is that this did not send a good message to the rest of the world.
Let's take a deeper dive on the global reaction and spend a few minutes hearing from Brazil now. Mauricio Santoro is a professor of political science at the State University of Rio de Janeiro. He's in Rio. Mauricio, thanks for being with us. You watched last night's debate. What was your overall reaction?
We have been following the presidential election in the United States very closely in Brazil, because we believe that it's not just about the U.S., it's also about us. Because the president of Brazil is a huge supporter of Trump, and he considers the American president to be his role model. So we believe that the Brazilian president is going to replicate in this country what Trump is doing right now in the United States, including perhaps the way that he's behaving on the debates.
So you're right. Many analysts have seen parallels between Trump and Jair Bolsonaro. What did you see last night that reinforced those parallels, and where do those thoughts take you?
It's very hard for them, for Trump and Bolsonaro, to follow the rules, to follow the traditional way to behave in a democracy. For example, how you should respect your opponent, how you should respect the press. They always had this very harsh way to deal with reporters and with other politicians. The second point is this idea that politics today is about provocation, to behave in a very difficult way, to provoke angry reactions from your opponents, from the people who disagree with you and to mobilize your political base. This in the case of Bolsonaro, the Brazilian president, he actually didn't go to any debate, at least in the second round in the Brazilian presidential election 2 years ago. It was all about using the social media to do lives, using his own narrative about the political events, but refusing to engage with a dialogue with other politicians. And this was the first time in Brazil that something like that happened.
Really? The first time? You've never seen anything like this?
Never. Well, sometimes you had a politician that missed a couple of debates, but at least in the second round, they were present. And 2 years ago, something different happened in Brazil. And of course, that yesterday, Trump was in the debate, but was he really debating? It sounded more like a performance, more like a one-way narrative than a real political debate.
On the substance of the debate, during a question on climate change, Vice President Biden brought up the Amazon rainforest. Let's take a listen.
The rainforests of Brazil are being torn down, are being ripped down. More carbon is absorbed in that rainforest than every bit of carbon that's emitted in the United States. Instead of doing something about that, I would be gathering up and making sure we had the countries of the world coming up with $20 billion and say, here's $20 billion. Stop. Tearing down the forest.
Mauricio, was it unusual to hear the Amazon mentioned in a U.S. debate this way? And is Biden's proposal being received, if at all, in Brazil?
It's very unusual for Brazil to be mentioned in an American presidential debate. And the majority of people in Brazil disagree with what the government is doing right now, with the lack of action to stop deforestation, to stop the big fires in the Amazon. I would say that the Amazon and climate change are now the biggest reason why Brazil is important for international politics. And with the current government, it's a problem. It's something difficult for the Brazilian foreign policy, but it can be an asset. It can be a way that Brazil is going to be able to influence the global agenda, the international discussions. So Brazilians are paying attention, and many people in Brazil have the conscience about how important the Amazon is to global climate change.
Mm. And yet I know Bolsonaro is very popular in Brazil. Do you believe many Brazilians were looking at Trump's performance saying, this is the kind of leadership we want from the U.S.?
The popularity of Bolsonaro in Brazil has been oscillating between 35 and 40%, just a little below what Trump enjoys now in the United States. And for many of Bolsonaro's supporters, Trump is a role model. They really like when the two presidents are together, when they pay compliments to each other. And many people in Brazil believe that Trump is a great leader because they like the way that he criticizes the press, the traditional politician, the political establishment, and so on. And if you stop to look what's happening now in Brazil and in the United States, you are going to see many points in common. The humanitarian crisis of the pandemic, the economic recession. So what is happening in the United States in the political campaign, in the election, it's a kind of laboratory to what may happen in Brazil in a couple of years. So this is why we in Brazil are paying lots of attention to what's happening now in American campaign.
Something you said a moment ago, Mauricio, that the U.S. election is kind of a laboratory for Brazil. Is there anything you're seeing specifically that you're worried about?
Oh, yes, no doubt about that. I'm very worried, especially about how Trump is questioning the results of the election, saying that he could go to the Supreme Court, that he could mobilize his supporters on the streets. This is exactly what I fear that Bolsonaro may do in Brazil in a couple of years. And what happens in the United States has a very strong global impact for democracy all around the world. The good things, the good ideas, but also the bad things and the crisis.
Mauricio Santoro is a professor of political science at the State University of Rio de Janeiro. Mauricio, thank you for your reaction to our presidential debate last night.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure.
There are lots of theories and predictions about the various things that could go wrong with the U.S. November election. That makes the role of election observers perhaps more important than ever, especially international election observers who could be more impartial than American citizens. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, these monitors have just started their mission in the U.S.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, is the largest international body charged with monitoring elections. It wanted to bring 500 observers for the upcoming U.S. elections. Instead, there will be about 130, mostly because of COVID concerns. Fewer people than expected volunteered to come to the U.S.
The major thing that we're going to have to make an adjustment on is the actual in-polling station election day observation. That said, all other aspects of the mission remain effectively unchanged.
That's the leader of the OSCE's mission in the U.S., Polish Senator and European Parliament member Ursula Gatzik.
At the end of the day, I'm still certain it's going to be accurate. It's going to be a true reflection, an impartial reflection, an objective of what's been happening here in the United States.
Gatzik will lead a 30-member team that will issue an interim report in 3 weeks.
We're following legal developments. We're following the campaign in as much as the environment, the atmosphere of the campaign. We're following the postal ballots.
Just before the election, Gatzik's team will be joined by 100 additional monitors from 30 countries. They'll deploy in pairs under a mandate of strict non-interference. They'll be watching things like voter registration, mail-in ballots, and access to the polls. They'll also look at media coverage, including intolerant rhetoric. Gatzik says the monitors will attempt to compensate for their smaller numbers by observing a, quote, representative sample of polling locations.
What we're having to go to do on election day is pick our places well, but it will be, I would say, the analysis there will be more anecdotal because the sample group will regrettably be too small, and that is not anybody's fault.
The OSCE typically observes elections in developing countries, but like all other 56 members of the global organization, the U.S. is also obligated to invite international election observers. Those observers only started coming in 2002, after the messy Bush v. Gore election of 2000. Not all states have allowed the monitors in, though. This year, just 28 states and the District of Columbia have invited international observers. There's also the added complications of President Trump's repeated questioning of mail-in ballots, claims of a rigged election, and evasion on whether he'll respect the result of the election. Gatzik refused to comment on what she called those hypotheticals.
At this stage, you can't prejudge. You know, I mean, I'm hearing that there are concerns, but then we're evidence-based. We need to see, you know, we need to see the facts. We need to see whether things really do or do not go wrong.
But those concerns are why it's so important to have international monitors, says Judith Kelly, a professor of political science and dean of Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy.
What I find striking is that the United States, in many ways, was the driving force behind the creation of the whole idea of international election observers and have fostered that movement throughout the world, observing elections worldwide. And it is rather inconceivable that we're finding ourselves in a situation now where we legitimately appear to be having a need for them ourselves.
In developing countries, she says international monitors have been instrumental in shoring up public confidence in elections. But Kelly says they may not have that effect this time.
I am skeptical that they will have any impact in the United States, specifically in this election. Not because they don't have the potential to do so, but because they won't be given the opportunity to do so.
The day after the election, the OSCE team will hold a press conference to talk about their initial findings. Afterward, as usual, they're prepared to stay to monitor the counting of ballots and whatever court process may play out to decide the election. Roughly 2 months later, they'll issue a final report with recommendations for what could have been done better. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The World takes you from Brazil to Yemen coming up, and later in the hour to Iraq and the British stage. As usual, today's show connects you to stories from many parts of the world. That connection continues on social media, even when we're not in your ears. Follow us on Twitter. We're at The World. Connect with our team of journalists and join the conversation about the stories that keep you thinking. And while you're at it, share the stories that really impact you. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Yemen is in its sixth year of war, but this week some hope that there's a breakthrough that could lead to peace. Representatives for Yemen's main warring sides met in Switzerland and hashed out a deal to release some prisoners of war.
You have agreed to immediately release 1,081 individuals.
That's UN negotiator Martin Griffiths congratulating the people who signed the agreement. The prisoner exchange is being managed by the International Committee for the Red Cross. Yara Kaweja is spokesperson for ICRC operations in Yemen, and she joins us from Cairo. Yara, I want to know more about how big a deal this breakthrough really is. How significant is this prisoner swap, and what it could then lead to?
I think that the deal that has been reached by the parties to the conflict in Yemen is really significant. 1,081 person will come back to their families after long years of separation. This is very important because maybe it's too early to speak about restoring peace in Yemen, but let us say that this is the first step of a path that the Yemenis are looking for to reestablish their lives and to live in better conditions where war does not prevail in their country.
There are three groups involved here: Houthi rebels, a Saudi Arabian-led coalition, and the Yemeni government. And more than 1,000 prisoners are behind bars, each one with a name, a story. How does the ICRC manage a prisoner release on this scale?
Well, let us first agree that indeed this is very big and it's challenging as an operation. But the ICRC is very much committed to make it happen in a very successful way. That is why now we have our teams working and already started with the pre-departure interviews with the detainees to make sure that we collect all the information needed, also to see if they are okay with all the process of the release.
Yemen, like so much of the rest of the world, is suffering the blow from COVID-19. So what can you tell us about the health of the prisoners right now?
Well, at the moment, we still don't have information on their health situation, but indeed we have factored the element of COVID-19 in our plan. If any detainee will show COVID-19 symptoms, we're going to make sure that they don't transmit the disease to other detainees, but also to make sure that they get the treatment and they go back safely to their families.
And Yara, when do these assessments happen? Like, what is the timeline for these releases and prisoner swaps?
Maybe we're being optimistic, but hopefully the operation will take place over the 15th of October and the 16th of October. So at the moment, we have our teams already preparing themselves on every front, and also detaining parties, they're doing their part of the job and the assessment needed to select the gathering points and to make sure that on the day of the operation, the detainees are ready to be transferred by the International Committee of the Red Cross.
We have to recognize, though, that conditions across Yemen are abysmal. There's widespread famine, there's poverty, there's cholera in addition to COVID-19. So where will these prisoners go ultimately when they're released from custody?
It depends on what front we're talking about, because there's some detainees who will go back to their countries outside of Yemen, but there's also the Yemeni detainees who are coming back to their home. And when we say home, we actually mean the actual home, because once they will arrive to the airport, the ICRC will give them clothes, will give them hygiene material, and will also give them money to make sure that they can go back to their houses, to their families, and be in a good situation and to be able to rebuild their lives a bit by bit.
Yara Kaweja is a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. She's been explaining a plan to swap prisoners of war in Yemen. Yara, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Schools across Mexico are closed because of the coronavirus, and millions of kids are dropping out because they don't have access to online learning. The World's Jorge Valencia found one solution in Mexico City at a local tortilla shop.
The conveyor belt at the Abuela Tortilla Mill is a little creaky after years of rolling out thousands of fresh tortillas every morning.
¿Cuántos kilos crees que vendemos al día?
One of the owners, Fernando Lozano, stops to think about exactly how many pounds they produce every day.
Aproximadamente unos 200 kilos, más o
menos. I don't know, about 200 kilograms, he says, or roughly 440 pounds on the daily. That sounds about right for a neighborhood tortilla mill in a country where the tortilla is even more common than, say, bread is in the United States. It's a staple, Lozano explains. The tortilla in Mexico goes with everything, from street food to fine dining. and the Abuela tortilla mill toward the southern edge of Mexico City became a sort of community center a few months ago as Lozano and his wife dealt with a personal tragedy. In February, they lost a newborn baby.
Mi bebé murió y yo me estaba dejando morir.
My baby died, and I was letting myself die, says Lozano's partner in life and in business, Dalia Davila. So when the pandemic started, they wanted to do something for someone other than themselves. They began giving out food to neighbors in need, and when they realized many children in the neighborhood had no access to the internet, they began letting kids sit in their pickup truck and connect to their Wi-Fi to do their homework. On a recent Wednesday, Davila calls out to the owner of the convenience store next door.
Él es el vecino. Él nos presta su patio.
Davila says the neighbor lets kids use his sidewalk for a pandemic version of physical education. She says the owner of the hardware store down the block gave them food, and the owner of a clothing store gave them face masks.
Todo héroe de Padierna se contagió. De empatía, de esperanza, de solidaridad.
The entire neighborhood became infected with empathy, hope, and solidarity, Davila says. Eventually, the owners of the Abuela tortilla mill set up a makeshift classroom. They took an empty storefront across the street and hooked it up with a television and a whiteboard and gave a few kids smartphones. Dominga Ortiz lives three blocks away and brings her children every day. My children aren't the only ones, Ortiz says. In fact, Mexico's education ministry estimates some 2.5 million students have dropped out of school since schools closed in March. And it's largely because they can't access their school materials.
Pues es un poco complicado porque pues no cuento yo con los dispositivos, no cuento con internet.
Ortiz says that in her family's case, it's not easy because they don't have a television or the internet to access the public school's distance learning program. That's the case for almost half the population in Mexico City, according to the most recent census. And in many cases, families face problems even more basic than connectivity.
Bueno, mi marido es electricista.
Ortiz says work is hard to come by these days. She says she works cleaning houses, her husband is an electrician, and sometimes they don't have enough money to eat. She's doing her best, she says, to not let her children fall behind.
Hello.
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 When I visit the Abuela Tortilla Mill, three students have just wrapped up an English class with a volunteer tutor. They're learning greetings and numbers. 11-year-old Maria de la Luz Carreño asks me to count with her.
13, 14, 15.
Carreño says she's enjoying learning a new language. She says she also misses her math class.
Me gusta más las clases de matemáticas, las divisiones, multiplicaciones.
She says her favorite part of math was multiplying and dividing. And of course, she misses her classmates.
Yadira, Fernanda, Dulce, y Alessandra.
Carreño doesn't know how her classmates are managing to study. It's been hard to stay in touch. In the meantime, school for her is right here, across the street from the tortilla mill La Abuela. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
More coming up in the next half hour. You're listening to The World. The U.S. intelligence community needs to rethink its China strategy. That's a finding of a new congressional report.
For many years, the president had nothing but praise for President Xi. He's decided it's politically advantageous to change his tune now.
A House panel says the intelligence community is stuck in a post-9/11 mindset. That's coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A couple of moments in last night's presidential debate where the two candidates, President Donald Trump and Joe Biden, were sparring over who was tougher on China.
You know, he talks about the art of the deal. China's perfected the art of the steal. We have a higher deficit with China now than we did before. We have the highest trade deficit
China
with Mexico.
China ate your lunch, down 8%. China ate your lunch, Joe.
China bashing during a U.S. presidential election is nothing new, but this year the China threat is more ominous and difficult to confront. That's the assessment of the House Intelligence Committee in a new report released today. It warns that the U.S. intelligence community is stumbling as it increasingly goes head-to-head with Beijing. Representative Adam Schiff, a California Democrat, chairs the panel. Congressman, what are the key findings of the report?
After decades of a focus on the counterterrorism mission, which was very largely successful in terms of thwarting additional attacks against the United States and against our homeland. Our ability to confront hard targets like China has really atrophied. We don't have the personnel, the language skills, the expertise, and the prioritization of resources that we really should to deal with a threat that is so cross-cutting against every field of domain, military, air, cyber, technology, diplomacy, foreign investment. And so we have a lot of work to do.
Wouldn't it make more sense to put resources and emphasis on creating a constructive relationship with China? I mean, I don't want to sound naive, but the U.S. and Chinese economies are so intertwined. This approach seems like it might lose sight of mutual interests.
Well, I think we should do everything possible to make sure that this doesn't become another Cold War. But of course, China has a big say in what kind of relationship they want to have. At present, it appears that China has determined to be increasingly aggressive and bellicose in the region, project its power around the world, seek to change international institutions, move them away from a law-based, rules-based order to one where might makes right. So we have very different worldviews, very different agendas. I think we ought to try to avoid conflict, but we can't be blind to the challenge that's presented both to freedom-loving people around the world, but to our defense as well as our economy.
Yeah, Congressman Schiff, at a very practical level, I'm thinking language skills. We've been reporting on our show that the U.S. has gutted the Confucius Institutes. These are Chinese government-funded outposts that offer Chinese language and culture classes. So what resources are you proposing to fill the language gap? Because robots can only do so much. Don't we need linguists?
Well, we absolutely need linguists. And you're right, that's going to require resources. And we don't want to rely on resources that we don't have trust in. So we need to make sure that we get out and we recruit the very best personnel and that we train them and we make use of their incredible talent. That's going to mean choices because the resources are not unlimited. And so we need to figure out, okay, where are we deploying our resources now? To what degree are we in the intelligence world still fighting the last war? And that may be the last war on terror. And how do we redeploy and reallocate to these emerging priorities, these hard target nation state actors that never went away, but have changed in their complexity and the danger they present?
Yeah, I was wondering about that because Trump's rhetoric around China has been competitive, angry, and even insulting in recent months. But it seems you and other Democrats' concerns about China may not be laden with his words, but you're just as concerned by the threat. What do you really see as the differences in your two positions, Congressman, and what do you both want as outcomes?
You know, I think the president's policy is essentially a pro-Donald Trump policy, which means that it's idiosyncratic and divorced from America's national interests. So at times it's praising President Xi, at times it's attacking President Xi, at times it is making ZTE a national security issue, at other times it's just another trade issue. This, you know, kind of schizophrenic approach to our relations with China, of course, doesn't improve the United States position. The trade policies have been an utter failure. Our economic situation has not improved. Our position in the world has declined. What we need, I think, is a consistent and thoughtful approach to meeting China's rise in every domain. It means we need to be more competitive in terms of our engagement around the world with development assistance to meet their Belt and Road Initiative. It means we need to think about the investments we need to make in space to protect our satellites and to meet challenges posed by China in space. It means that we need to look at the cyber issues and China's very aggressive cyber espionage and cyber theft of intellectual property. It means that we need to develop coalitions in the South China Sea and elsewhere. And so, you know, I think those are or should be bipartisan priorities. The difference is in how those priorities are effectuated. And this administration, I think, has done a terrible job because its policy is really motivated by the whims of the president, not any coherent view of China or the United States or anything else.
Are you worried, Congressman Schiff, that in this election year, what passes for debate will be seen by many as knee-jerk bashing and xenophobia? I mean, is that a legitimate worry for both parties? And if Biden wins, how do you pack that all back up?
You know, I think China understands the political dynamic and what took place during the debate. Although I have to say, I think for all of us watching the debate last night, watching our president's performance was just a national embarrassment.
Representative Adam Schiff, a California Democrat, chairs the House Intelligence Committee. He's been telling us about a new House Intelligence report on confronting China. Congressman, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Every year, the European Parliament presents an award known as the Sakharov Prize. It goes to people and organizations that defend human rights and fundamental freedoms. This year, a man from Iraq has been nominated. Archbishop Najib Mikhail Musa fled his city in northern Iraq just as the Islamic State was snatching up territory in 2014. The archbishop escaped with his life. The award nomination is for what he was able to bring with him. The world's Shirin Jafari has his story.
The night of August 6, 2014 is one that Archbishop Najib Mikhail Musa will never forget. He even has a name for it.
I call it Black Night.
Black Night, because it was the most harrowing experience of his life, he says. He'd found out that the Islamic State militants were about to take over his city of Qarakosh in northern Iraq.
At midnight, with two brothers, I start to leave with many thousands of families crying, shouting, and most of them, they have no cars.
The residents of Qarakosh had reason to escape. The city was home to Iraq's largest Christian communities, and the Islamic State, a Sunni extremist group, believes that Christians are inferior.
I feel that something very dangerous happened against our life and against our heritage.
As a prominent leader in the local Catholic community, Musa was in charge of thousands of ancient manuscripts covering a wide range of subjects.
Theology, philosophy, astrology, astronomy, medicine.
Stacks of handwritten texts from the 12th and 13th centuries.
This collection is very important for all humanity because they don't talk about just a Christian or just about Iraq, but they're talking about human history.
He was worried that ISIS would destroy them, and he had good reason to be concerned. He had fled with them once before. In 2003, he says, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq unleashed a wave of anti-Christian attacks across the country. His church in Mosul was targeted.
And also they put my name in the list of the dangerous person to be killed.
In 2007, Musa thought it was no longer safe to stay in Mosul. But if he was leaving, he was taking the documents with him. Over several clandestine trips, he moved them to Qarakosh, about 20 miles south of Mosul. Then, on that black night in August 2014, he found himself doing the same thing again.
We put what we had in the cars. We had two cars. And also, when we find many peoples crying without car and they want to save their life, we ask them to coming in our car and sitting on the heritage.
Men, women, children sat on top of cardboard boxes full of fragile ancient manuscripts.
And we said we will live together or we will die together.
The cars sped off into the darkness, headed to the Kurdish region of Iraq, to safety.
At 5:30 a.m., a young girl start saying, "Father, Father, look at your right." And I see many cars with ISIS with their black and white flags, and they are ready to attack us.
That's it, he thought. They were about to be ambushed.
And I start to pray. Really, I ask God to give me 10 hands or 10 legs to save.
More strength to save the people and the manuscripts. As they drove away from the city, Musa remembers Kurdish security forces opening fire on the ISIS convoy speeding to town. They managed to hold them back while his car and other civilians got through the checkpoints. Archbishop Musa and the others in the caravan eventually made it to safety. But they were lucky, says Rain Hanna, who heads the Assyrian Policy Institute, a U.S.-based nonprofit that advocates for the rights of minorities in the Middle East. Not all Christians in Qarakosh were able to leave, she says.
There was a smaller number of Christians or Assyrians that lived under ISIS rule. And of course, these were more elderly members of the community who were not able to travel. And you can imagine that it was a very traumatic experience, very scary and unknown on the day-to-day basis.
Human rights groups have documented atrocities against Christians in areas under ISIS control. They say what happened to the Yazidis was even worse, calling it a genocide. The Islamic State also pillaged and destroyed heritage sites. For a while, it was making money off of selling historic artifacts on the black market. The documents that Archbishop Musa helped save have been digitized and exhibited in France and Italy. As for where they are now...
I don't tell you exactly where is it.
Fair enough. But he says they're still in Iraq, and he wants to keep it that way. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Turkey is one of the few Muslim-majority countries where abortion is legal. But Turkey's conservative government is working to limit abortion access. Many public hospitals have stopped providing them. Even among friends, abortion remains a taboo subject. From Istanbul, reporter Fariba Nawa has our story.
It's late morning, and Sevilla invites me to meet her at her home in a hillside middle-class neighborhood. When I arrive, she's with three other women friends. They ask me only to use their first names for privacy. The four of them get together often, drink tea, and eat with laughter. But today's gathering is about to turn tense. Sevilay is a stay-at-home mom who wants to share her struggle with abortion to make it easier for others. It's rare for a Turkish woman to publicly talk about having an abortion.
I became very upset when I learned about my pregnancy. I wondered whether I could do it or not. I was already having a hard time with two kids. There was nobody that could help me.
Her friend Shada is the loudest in the group. She shakes her head at Sevilay.
There are many things you can do to prevent a pregnancy right now. You can tie your tubes, you can use birth control. If you don't use all these options and you end up getting pregnant with a child, you should give birth to them.
Shada turns to me for validation.
Now that I know Sevilay's situation, I feel like I'm sharing her sin. And this is a sin after all.
Sevilay is taken aback by Shada's sharp judgment, but keeps her cool. Sevilay is 38 years old with kind eyes. She dropped out of university, got married, and worked in healthcare for a while. She and her husband have two small children. To keep up their middle-class lifestyle, two kids are all they can afford.
I'm trying to set higher standards for my children. I'm trying to provide them a good life. I can give birth to five children and can raise them very well, but I cannot provide them good opportunities.
Sevilay decided to get an abortion with her husband's permission, which she needs legally. She thought the decision would be the hardest part, but finding a hospital was even harder. Private hospitals cost too much, but public ones kept turning her away. Sevilay reached out to Mor Çatı, a women's rights group that helped her find a public hospital to do it for free. But even that hospital's staff gave Sevilay a guilt trip and threatened her.
They said, if you come to this hospital for another abortion, we won't let you in.
She had the abortion at 9 weeks, 1 week before it became illegal. Sevilay was broken from the emotional toll and harsh treatment. The abortion itself was awful.
I felt bad. I woke up crying. To be honest, sometimes my heart aches.
The stigma of abortion remains deep in Turkey. It became legal here in 1983. Wealthier women from Saudi and Iran, where abortion is banned, come here to have one. But in the last decade, the conservative AK Party and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan have been chipping away at reproductive rights. In 2012, the government tried to reduce the 10-week pregnancy limit to 6 weeks, but feminists fought back and won. Kürtajlı bir cinayet olarak görüyorum. Erdogan publicly calls abortion murder and says women should have at least three children. Public hospitals can simply refuse women access based on what the president says, not the law. So low-income women like Syrian refugees turn to back-alley clinics.
Dışarıdan bakıldığında kuaför ama içeride insan sağlığıyla oynandı.
Last year, news broke that police had raided a clinic fronting as a Syrian hair salon. 3 people were arrested. Hazal Atai is an outreach coordinator at Women on Web, a Dutch-based platform that helps women get access to abortions in restrictive countries. Turkey banned Women on Web's website in 2016, but Turkish women still find ways to contact them. Hazal translates some of the recent letters she has gotten from Turkey, including this one from a woman in Erzurum.
She's 23 years old, and she wrote to us saying, "I'm sure this situation is difficult for everyone, but if my family learns about the pregnancy, they won't let me live. I know you help a lot of people, but you don't know where I live, and you don't know my family. You are my only hope." Here is another message from Istanbul.
2 other letters from women in Istanbul reflect the same desperation. One woman says she doesn't have the money to get an abortion. Another has run away from a violent husband but needs his permission to abort her pregnancy.
Yani bakmıyor ki devlet benim çocuğuma.
Tamam ama devlet senin yatağına karışmıyor mesela yani.
Back in Sevilay's home in Istanbul, the debate rages between the 4 friends.
Kadın tek, sen tek başına.
Sevilay gets support from her activist friend Sevcan as Shada continues to criticize.
Devlet sana her şekilde.
The state will help you with your child.
Yani insanlar aç kalan bebekler.
No, it doesn't. There are babies dying from hunger in this country. Women can't buy formula for their babies.
Yani bana göre aldırması.
I think she had no reason to get an abortion.
Sevcan says it's a woman's decision whether she wants to have an abortion, not the state's. Then she reminds her friends about solidarity.
Sonuna kadar savaşacağım. Kadınlar birlikte güçlüdür.
Women are strong together. We have to support each other all the time. We have to support each other even if we don't have the same opinions.
Sevilay sits quietly on her couch. Her eyes are fixed on the ground. Her son comes into the room to watch TV, and she holds him. For the World, Fariba Nawa, Istanbul.
Since mid-August, fires have been ripping up and down the West Coast. This week, a new fire is burning in Northern California, forcing tens of thousands of people to evacuate. Immigrant farm workers in the U.S. have been hit especially hard this year, first by COVID-19 and now by these fires. The World's Monica Campbell has been speaking with some of those farm workers. Monica, this latest fire is hitting California's Napa Valley region, famous for its wineries. What have you heard from the immigrant farm workers who work the vineyards? What are they saying about the impact of the fires on their lives?
Right. Well, there's a lot of worry. This is a part of California that leans heavily on a massive and largely immigrant workforce from Mexico and parts of Central America, primarily lower income workers who may be losing their homes in the fires and also their work. I spoke with Arnolfo Solorio about this. He's a longtime farm worker in Napa Valley. He came to the U.S. to work the farms when he was just 14 years old, and he's just trying to get through this year.
It's a year to forget or a year not to remember. We were dealing with COVID-19, and now we're dealing with all these fires and the smoke and all this, yes.
COVID-19 has hit farmworking communities quite hard because they can be largely Latino communities. And as we know, they've been disproportionately impacted by the virus for many reasons. But one is because they don't often have the choice to work from home. So now you have the smoke on top of it. Arnulfo is now in his 50s after arriving to the United States as a teenager. And he's managing crews of workers in the vineyards in Napa, and the fires are close. People are needing to harvest those grapes, so they're working really quickly if they can get to them, trying to protect equipment. So you have people working really long, fast shifts right now.
And at the same time, there are evacuations and road closures in wine country right now. What is the economic impact to the region, and will that affect the number of farm workers who can actually work and earn money right now?
Right. These fires can stop everything, even parts of a billion-dollar wine industry. This is also what Arnulfo told me.
So they're going to leave the fruit on the vine. That means less work for the farm workers. We're putting together a program so that we can give them financial aid.
Arnulfo is basically crowdsourcing it and getting people to contribute. Monica, you've also reported on how people continue to work even when the wildfires are filling the air with intense smoke. I mean, that can't be healthy, but do those workers have a choice?
Yeah, I mean, there are efforts to try and provide better masks, respirators for people when they're working in these smoking conditions, which is still allowed. It's incredible. I mean, you know, we can be on a part of the West Coast right now that's totally socked in with smoke. And you have workers out there in this heavy smoke, you know, in the fields tending to the crops. And there's a pressure, you know, on their end to keep working because of, you know, the need to send money back home or their just day-to-day livelihood. But it's also allowed. You know, employers aren't breaking the law by having their workers out in the field. This is actually allowed by regulators. And I spoke with Armando Alenas about this. He's with the United Farm Workers. And I asked him, you know, how is this possible that people are still working in these heavy, smoky conditions when we know it's clearly not healthy for them?
The ag industry is a huge powerhouse in the state and throughout the country. And so the advocacy groups, we do our best. But, you know, sometimes money talks.
And Marco, you know, I've talked to regulators, state regulators here in California themselves who say, we do want better regulations, stricter regulations, but that comes with a lot of resistance because, you know, more regulations, more equipment, maybe people unable to get to the crops. That's going to hit the bottom line of big companies that, you know, help provide the food that we all eat.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, with the latest on working conditions for immigrant farm workers in the midst of fires and in the midst of COVID in Northern California. Monica, thank you.
You're welcome.
We all know social distancing keeps us safer from the coronavirus. So across the globe, we're seeing spaces redesigned and repurposed. Empty hotels have become dorms, arenas, voting locations. And in the UK, with the great thespian tradition on pause, theaters have become courtrooms. The Lowry Theatre in Salford, England, which hosts plays and musicals, has been converted to help tackle a backlog of nearly 50,000 legal cases. Talk about your courtroom dramas. Rachel Miller is the Lowry's marketing director. Rachel, thanks for being with us. Whose idea was this? Have you ever seen anything like this before?
No, it was very much a new thing. We reached out to the court system and basically we said, why don't we have this relationship? Why don't we have this conversation? We've got the space, they've got the backlog. We've all been under financial crisis. We're in obviously a very difficult situation at the moment. From our point of view, having no performances on is a huge impact. So it really is a partnership that's working very well for both parties.
Mm. So have any of your theatre workers been able to work for the courts in this interim?
There will only be a small number of the theatre staff that will be working for the courts, but it'll be a 9-to-5 operation during the daytime for the courts. We'll then close down the building and have a thorough clean through, a deep clean through of the building, and then be able to open in the evenings for our theatre performances.
Got it. Well, I'm looking at a picture of the theatre. I would like you to describe the Lowry Theatre and how it's been rearranged, like the seats, the stage. What have they become, and where do the judge, jurors, and defendants sit in the theatre?
Okay, so what's happened is the lower seating level, all of the seats have come out. It's flat floor with tables and seats, very much as a courtroom environment. There is then, on the stage will be where the judge will sit, and behind that there's the crest, and there's quite a large security team attached to it to make sure that, you know, it's a safe building.
Yeah, the pictures I'm seeing of the Lowry, I mean, it's a classic theatre, dark wood, and thick floor-length curtains. It's clearly a theatre. Is there any worry that these court proceedings might not be taken as seriously as they would be in an actual courtroom?
I don't think that would be the case. I've actually been into the space myself, and I was quite surprised how somber the space did actually feel. Mm. You've got to remember that the rest of the building will be closed down except for these court cases during the day. The staff are appropriately presenting themselves with dress code and their attitude. So it is very, very much the case that people are understanding that it's a very serious environment that they need to be in during the daytime.
As you know, Rachel, the arts sector everywhere has been hit hard by the pandemic. What about the Lowry Theatre? How's it fared? And are you getting paid for housing these courts?
Yes, it's a hire. There is a financial agreement in place, which is a substantial amount for us. That hire fee is helping us greatly to continue with a lot of important work that we do.
Is it hope that this temporary court at the Lowry Theatre will be able to get through that massive backlog of cases?
I think it will be a contributor, but there is still a huge backlog. But it's certainly going to address some of the cases that people have been waiting, some of them up to 6 months for their cases to be heard. So hopefully it will help some of those people to get some closure on the situations that they're in.
Rachel Miller is the marketing director at the Lowry, a theatre and gallery outside of Manchester in the UK. Rachel, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And this is where I get to say either case closed or curtain. Today, both seem to work. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We'll be back with you all tomorrow.